This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Fred Fellaman, Northwest consultant for Friends of the Earth. Fred is a longtime maritime activist and whale biologist. He championed creation of the Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary and the Nia Bay rescue tug and successfully challenged BP's expansion of a refinery dock. Fred Fellaman is here today to tell us about proposed fossil fuel terminals and transport through Washington State and Puget Sound and the implications for both communities and the environment. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you.
Would you remind us of why there are proposals for terminals at Northwest ports for export of fossil fuels, both coal and oil?
Well, the coal and the oil have to be looked at slightly separate buckets, but their implications are very similar. The coal side of the story, which has received most of the attention so far, is really a result of the fact that the Obama administration has moved to basically phase out coal from our existing power plants and at the same time wants to double exports of commodities in general. But the coal, the commodity that is no longer able to fuel the power plants, is now being used to fuel the Chinese power plants. And so the target here is just to give the coal producers a market to get rid of the waste product, which is really what it should be thought of as, overseas. And so we're really exporting our climate problems rather than addressing them. So on the oil side of the story, we're dealing with a relatively recent discovery of this Bakken Shale. It's been known to exist, but the efficiency with which we can extract it and with the price of gas the way it is, it's become economically viable to exploit it. And this fuel is not connected to the marketplace by pipelines. So we have all these rail terminals being built to receive the crude. And it's not just for domestic consumption, or certainly not just for Washington State consumption. We're sort of like the port of call where it is then exported to California, and in fact, a couple of the companies have overseas permits. A lot of people believe that there's some sort of ban on the export of domestically produced fossil fuels, and it's really not the case. All you have to do is get a permit, and you can do that too. So the fact is that we're going to be serving from Washington State ports the West Coast and the Far East if left unabated. And then finally, the third fossil fuel source is the Canadian tar sands. And this has been receiving a lot of attention due to the Keystone Pipeline, which is still under contention. But the fact of the matter is, while we discuss Keystone, Kinder Morgan, who has the pipeline that runs from Alberta currently to Vancouver, British Columbia, is in the process of trying to twin that line. And so right now, we get 300,000 barrels a day of oil into Port of Vancouver, which is primarily exported, but they want to bring that up to like 890,000 barrels a day. And so the Chinese government has invested heavily in the tar sand oil fields themselves. And so really the goal is to get this oil to China. And Keystone is certainly less efficient to do that because you have to go through the Panama Canal to get there. So Port of Vancouver is now proposing to triple the dock in Burnaby, where they would be able to send three tankers out a day with this oil to go to the Far East. And then also, our refineries, if you look at a map, if you were to think about why would you ever build a refinery up in the backwaters of Puget Sound, you know, BP, ConocoPhillips, Tesoro, and Shell, that's up in the Anacortes and Cherry Point area, as well as U.S. Oil down in Tacoma. You would never build those facilities back there if your original plan was to receive oil by tanker. But in fact, those facilities were built to receive oil by pipeline from Alberta back in the 50s. And so that Trans Mountain pipeline that Kinder Morgan now runs that connects us to that facility is sort of like the historic way in which we got oil. When Alaska came online in the late 70s, 77 or so, there was this huge shift in oil spill risk exposure to our region. The only reason we had refinery docks at that time was to basically export the refined product and to have a place to discharge the waste from the refineries. Then all of a sudden we started seeing, you know, crude carriers coming in to serve the refineries instead of the pipeline over the land. And that's when Senator Magnuson made all of his remarkable efforts to try to address this risk. And we're hoping, in the course of developing this infographic, as we just did, to elevate the public awareness that this is a sort of an unprecedented time in terms of risk exposure changes that need a similar level of proactive thinking so that we don't have to learn by the school of hard knocks.
To what extent is the oil being transported by train now? Isn't that a relatively new development?
Well, it's interesting. There was a rail report just produced. The rail lines of the country are moving oil as the primary commodity this past year, whereas historically almost no oil moved by rail. So this is, again, in response to the fact that the fracking of the oil has produced so much more product and there isn't pipeline to connect it to the market. So this enormous expansion, they're building tanker cars for rails as fast as they can. And this is one of the challenges, in fact, in the public comment period is with the Federal Rail Association. They're trying to make new regulations for the safety of rail cars. And really the big question is whether it'll only apply to new cars or whether there's going to be a need to retrofit the old cars. And as we saw in Quebec, obviously there's room for significant improvement.
How many terminals for export of fossil fuels are currently under consideration?
Well, all the refineries, which is five, are currently taking shale by rail. In addition, we have three proposed in Grays Harbor. Two of them were just challenged by the Quinault Indian Tribe, and I was an expert witness on that case, and the Shoreline Hearings Board just threw that back at Ecology for their failure to consider the oil spill risks, among other things. And then there are two others in the Columbia River. So it's quite an onslaught. And unlike the three coal terminals that we're currently dealing with, unlike the EIS, that environmental impact statement, that will look at cumulative impacts associated with these three terminals, the nine or so shale terminals are being done individually without any cumulative impact analysis and without even an environmental impact statement. They have what they call a mitigated determination of non-significance. And what we challenged in the Grays Harbor was, how can you declare it's non-significant unless you do the analysis on vessel traffic beforehand? And so Ecology was suggesting that we'll give them the permit and after the fact we'll determine whether or not it's significant and maybe we'll mitigate it. And so obviously the Shoreline Hearings Board did not buy that logic, fortunately. So they're going to have to go back and do some analysis. So in fact, if the public, one thing we could use right now is calling on Governor Inslee to say, look, there should be a moratorium on any more of this shale terminal operations until a cumulative impact analysis is done.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Fred Fellerman, Northwest Consultant for Friends of the Earth. Our topic is the implication of proposed fossil fuel terminals and transport through Washington State and Puget Sound. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Just to give us a sense of how this fits into the very big picture, how much coal would be exported from the coal terminals that are being proposed?
The total volumes of coal are actually listed on the back of our infographic, which is currently being hosted by protectwatcom.org and friendsoftheearth.org websites. We'll both be having that. But if you include Canada, you're looking at three terminals in Vancouver, which will have 10 million metric tons, 8 million metric tons, 6 million metric tons. That's just for Vancouver. The big two for Washington State is the Gateway Terminal just south of Vancouver, which is just north of Bellingham. That alone will have 54 million metric tons. Again, this is all annually. And then the Millennium Bulk Terminal, that one is almost as big at 44 million metric tons. There is smaller ones in Columbia River, about 8 million metric tons at the Coyote Terminal, and that would basically cover the vast majority of it.
How does that compare with the amount of coal currently being exported? How much new capacity is being proposed?
There is very little in the way of coal export going on in Washington State. Currently, Vancouver has been the big coal export, though the West Shore Terminal up in Vancouver has been moving about 6 million metric tons annually. But for us, it's mostly a new game. And there's a little bit like, in fact, you know, this current facility at Millennial traditionally has received some coal to fire up a power plant that Weyerhaeuser uses. And so there was some very small amount just to do domestic things, but this whole idea of exporting coal is a relatively new phenomenon for our area.
Looking overall, how much of an increase in train traffic would there be across Washington State if all the terminal proposals being considered come to fruition?
Well, you have to look at the choke points in the system. And so to just say overall, it's kind of a hard estimate. But if you're unlucky enough to live in Spokane, for example, where it's sort of basically where everything comes through, you're looking at like 35 additional trains per day. That's like, you know, inordinate. And each one is a mile and a half long. So we're just looking at a tremendous increase of traffic for that. And then the urban ports like Tacoma and Seattle, while we won't see all of that traffic, the competition with the existing traffic is that much more significant. And then when you look at someplace like Tacoma, you also have, you know, two shale terminals being proposed for that area. So the cumulative impacts is what really needs to be looked at, and that the liquid fossil fuels and the coal need to be combined. We've already had the hearings on Gateway. November 18th is the deadline for the comment periods on Longview, and that's really where people need to be focused, because the way the trains work is that the heavy loaded trains, whether it be shale or coal, cannot climb over the pass, at least not in their what they call unit train dimension, a mile to a mile and a half long. So they all come in along the Columbia River. They all go through Spokane, come through the Columbia River. Some of them have their stops along the way. Then they start heading north up the I-5 corridor. Again, some will drop off in Tacoma and Seattle. But continuing on up to Bellingham, once those trains are unloaded, they're likely to go over like Stevens Pass or one of the other passes to the north. So while Bellingham is going to receive a lot of two-way traffic, a lot of the concerns that have been raised in Seattle about 18 trains a day or something like that is probably, you know, more likely going to be around 9, because they're going to bring the loaded inbound and then the outbound will go in the more rural communities. Not that that's good for the rural communities, but I just fear that the industry proponents are going to say, look, we've mitigated our impact. We're going to only do half as many as you think we're going to do. But it doesn't mean that some other community isn't also going to be exposed to that.
What are the safety issues for coal being transported by train?
Well, the reality is that the trains are inordinately heavy. And so there's a tremendous amount of wear and tear on the tracks. And as you've seen along Puget Sound, these tracks are very close to the shore. And these shorelines are very prone to sloughing due to the natural glaciated hillsides that we have. And so with all the rains and things like that, the problem is that these trains could get knocked off the tracks and dumped into the Sound. They will have, you know, wear and tear on the existing tracks that will require ongoing maintenance. And then there's always the concerns about just the crossings, you know, going through roads and places where people live. And there is a bunch of controversy about, you know, the BNSF and others are keep on talking about how much money they spend annually on maintaining the roads. And they are certainly trying to retain these sloughing hillsides. But when it comes to doing overpasses, the vast majority of that expenses to be incurred upon the local communities. So they don't consider that their problem.
Would the safety issues for oil transport be similar to those for coal?
Well, I just think the same, but twice as bad. It's the same nature, heavy trains, wear and tear on the tracks, potential for sloughing and all that. But when an oil train spills, it's far worse than when a coal train spills. You can actually hope to clean up a coal spill, but and it doesn't immediately go into solution, whereas oil spill has obviously is much greater challenge to clean up. And if more and more of this oil is also, including tar sand oil, this tar sand derived oil, it's what they call bitumen, which is really the heavy bound up tarry stuff. But in order for it to get into a train or into a pipeline, it has to be diluted with what they usually use is natural gas condensate. And these lighter materials will vaporize quickly, become a tremendous volatile explosive hazard, and then once they evaporate, the oil sinks. So if you get there quickly, you can get sick. If you get there late, you have to go to the bottom of the ocean to find it. You know, so it's really a lose-lose situation unless you're fully respirated protection, which we don't have that protection in all of our emergency response communities. It is a really nasty exposure that we're going to try to avoid.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Fred Fellman, Northwest Consultant for Friends of the Earth. Our topic is proposed fossil fuel terminals and transport through Washington State and Puget Sound, and the implication for both communities and the environment. Once the coal and the oil reach the proposed terminals, they will be loaded onto ships. How much of an increase in tanker traffic is going to take place if all the terminal proposals come to fruition?
Well, this is an interesting question in that I'm involved with this vessel traffic risk assessment that's being done in a collaborative fashion with the industry proponents as well as the state agencies and tribes. The way to look at this is by waterway. So you have to look at the Columbia River separate from Grays Harbor, separate from the entrance to the Strait of Juan de Fuca. It's relatively easy to do that with coal because we know we have to get rid of the coal. But what the refineries are claiming is that for every barrel of oil that comes into the refinery by train or pipe is going to be that less fewer barrels coming in by tanker. Unfortunately, while that sounds really good, and so, you know, they're preparing us to have to say, what, are you pro-tanker? The reality of the matter is that they are also exporting crude oil, and nothing precludes them from doing that. So while the rhetoric is that this is actually going to reduce tanker traffic, in the analysis of their transfer data, I am now seeing, you know, crude oil leaving the dock from a refinery terminal rather than being refined first. So that means that we're going to get the trains and the tankers. And, you know, it's all about what the price point is at any given time. So whatever is happening now doesn't necessarily mean what we're going to see tomorrow. But what we can tell you at this point, if we're looking at all the coal and shale to be exported, which is primarily, I think, the goal, is that we'd look at about a 21% increase in tanker and bulk carrier traffic coming out of the Strait of Juan de Fuca, about a 383% increase out of Grays Harbor. Now, the Grays Harbor increase is much more dramatic, but they have far less traffic. So we're basically talking about last year they had about 82 ships come in. Well, with this proposed increases, we'd have about 314. Whereas the Strait of Juan de Fuca, we currently have 6,000 or so ships coming in and out. Coming in, we add an additional 1,300 deep draft vessels. And then for the Columbia River, it would be 153% increase going from today's numbers of about 1,400 ships to adding an additional 2,100 or so ships. So a tremendous increase. And the fact is, Columbia River and Grays Harbor never before had crude oil on the water. All the oil that was on the river before was refined product that would come down the Olympic pipeline into Portland and then would be distributed up and down the river. Now we're looking at black oil that is a much more persistent problem, and the equipment isn't in place to do that, but we're at the same time permitting the use of the waterway for this new pollutant. And there aren't currently the same tug escort requirements that we have in Puget Sound in Grays Harbor or Columbia River. So we don't have the preventative measures in place or the response measures in place, but we're freely permitting these folks willy-nilly.
What are the environmental implications?
Well, with the ship traffic, bulk carriers, which are basically, they look like tankers, and the only difference is that you can see hatch covers instead of pipes along the deck, but they carry their commodities, both of them carry their commodities, you know, underwater, deep in the hull. These vessels, very deep draft vessels, have up to 2 million gallons of bunker fuel. That's what runs these ships' engines, which is also another thing that all this export traffic, for every two ships you get into town, you have to deal with an additional bunker barge, which is just to fuel the ships. So about every other ship that comes to town takes fuel here, which significantly adds to the volume of traffic. So you have the risk of fuel transfers, you have the risks of groundings and collisions, and both the bulkers and the tankers have the persistent bunker fuel as well as the product is potentially making for a real mess of your decade.
Would you just give a brief outline of where the approval process currently stands for the terminals that are under consideration?
Well, there's quite the laundry list. Right now, what's going on in Grays Harbor is sort of on hiatus until Ecology comes back and does a full environmental review. We're hoping that this will have implications on the five coal rail terminals currently in the permitting process or under operation at the refineries. There is currently a public notice out from the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency on another mitigated determination of non-significance for a crude loading terminal at the U.S. oil refinery in Tacoma. That just came out. That would have an opportunity for public comment. It's funny, it's the Clean Air Agency, because when you decant oil from one vessel to another, there's all this vapor escape. So that's an interesting thing. So for air experts, that would be a really useful place to have some expertise brought to bear. And that's being done by, like I said, the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. Then there's most immediately, the thing that really is, you know, the second largest of all the terminals is this Millennial Terminal in Longview. The Millennial Bulk Coal Terminal in Longview, the comment period for that extends till November 18th. And so I would really hope that folks could weigh in on that, because that's second only to the Gateway Terminal up at Cherry Point. You know, Cherry Point, they already had the hearings, but they haven't released a finding of a draft environmental impact statement or anything. But the area is surrounded by an aquatic reserve. We have a herring population that is in steep decline, and our killer whales have had the worst year on record this year. Their population is down to 81 animals, and they spent the least amount of time in Puget Sound of any time since the 70s when we've been following them. So that is great concern. They actually did spend a lot of time this year off of the mouth of the Columbia River, because unlike the Fraser River this year, the Columbia actually had a strong king salmon run. I used to always say the only reason we have resident killer whales is because the Canadians didn't put a dam on the Fraser. And for whatever reasons, the Fraser was a major failure this year. But the Columbia River came through, and while the whales didn't spend a lot of time in Sound, they were hanging out off the coast. And for us to consider jeopardizing what might be the last straw to break their back is just unthinkable to me.
Who has the final authority to decide whether the terminals will be built?
Most of these projects are being done in a dual fashion. You have the Army Corps of Engineers as the federal lead agency if you're having to put sticks in the water, if it's to build a dock or modify a dock. And then you have the State Department of Ecology, who's doing shoreline permitting. And then it's typically whatever local jurisdiction, some county, whatever the county of jurisdiction is for the area. There's also, when you're dealing with the tank farms for the shale terminals, that's the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council, or EFSEC, they're affectionately referred to as. EFSEC was really established as a one-stop shop to facilitate siting of energy projects. And so there will be an EFSEC hearing coming up for Tesoro Savage Vancouver Energy Distribution Terminal, and they're going to be having those hearings down in Vancouver. But what I would really encourage folks to do is just to get on the web. The folks at Power Pass Coal are covering just the coal terminals. The shale terminals and the Trans Mountain, the tar sand terminals, Protect Whatcom and friendsoftheearth.org. We're going to have posting information on and letting people know about when the next opportunities to comment are.
In addition to attempting to stop the terminals from being built, what are your suggestions for other public policy steps that could be taken to make companies stop externalizing the costs of fossil fuels?
Well, one of the things that I've always focused on is that, you know, a lot of the reasons why Washington State is being targeted for all this is that we're like some sort of cheap date. You know, you can come here and, you know, exploit our deep waters, and you can bring in the deepest draft bulk carrier in the world to Cherry Point without dredging. That's great. And no mention of the herring and the killer whales, of course. But the reason why I focus so much on the vessel traffic issues is that the mitigations for bringing in huge ships in direct context of, like, next to the BP, largest refinery in the state, is where the Gateway Terminal is, it's not like it's rocket science. It's just expensive. And so if you're doing your bottom line analysis based on just sailing through here on rust bucket bulk carriers, which are the worst safety record in the world of any class of vessels, and that's part of your business model, then we got another thing to talk to you about. And the idea that while I do not condone facilitating the mass extinction of the planet through the use of these filthy fuels, if indeed the powers that be feel that a couple of jobs is worth shortchanging our kids' heritage, is, but they're going to have to do it in an appropriate fashion. as if there is any appropriate fashion, but there are standard maritime practices that are necessary to assure safety. And we're right now in the process of modeling some of these on this vessel traffic risk assessment, but right now there seems to be a free-for-all. So once we've identified what is considered prudent practice, whether they be tug escorts or a response tug in Sydney, British Columbia, or speed limits, or any number of other potential mitigation measures, then they have to go back and see, does it still pencil out? So this is one of the ways to make sure it's just not a complete externalization. Ultimately, we need an energy policy that makes this taxed and discouraged, and that we don't just think that we can address our climate change contributions by exporting our responsibilities.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, the governor's having a meeting next week where he's asking for input on what his climate work group should be addressing. And while I think we should compliment the governor for calling for cumulative impact analysis for the coal terminals, there's been a deafening silence on the oil terminals, and that he needs to apply the same concerns that he's expressed on coal to oil, and that we should not be allowing these projects to be moving forward until we look at the context of not only the 9 oil terminals themselves in the context with each other, but we have to look at them in the context of the 3 coal terminals and then whatever's going on in Canada, because that's when you're going to look at cumulative impacts. And the National Environmental Policy Act and the State Environmental Policy Act completely allow for, even though they're not directly related to this project, you can't beam the coal and oil into the dock to get it out of here, nor can you beam it out of here. So you have to look at the cumulative impacts to the communities that the trains are going to go through, as well as the communities that are going to have the ship sail through.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Fred.
Thank you.
You are just listening to Fred Fellaman, Northwest Consultant for Friends of the Earth. For more information, check on the web at powerpastcoal.org, protectwatcom.org, and also foe.org. Again, powerpastcoal.org, protectwatcom.org, and foe.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.